there. That was good. Well, I want to thank Siv and Karina for inviting me. It's been interesting to see how mechanics and neurosciences interact and to see if I can make any contribution to the workshop based on my background. When I discussed what I might talk about, it was suggested I might just talk about some general ideas from continuum mechanics and how they relate to brain neuromechanics. So the outline of the talk is this. I'm going to introduce some basic notions for mechanics, which you've all seen before. Hopefully, I'll say a few new things about them, introduce you to the elements of viscoelastic response, finish off with models of microstructural change to show you how they might be related to neuromechanics. My ideas are formed for two things, what I have learned about hydrocephalus, but being from the Detroit area and knowing that head injury studies are important in car crash studies, there's another aspect of brain which hasn't been discussed here very much. It's this. What happens if your skull starts rotating due to an impact? Well, I tell my students that the brain sloshes around inside the skull. They use the word slosh deliberately, as if you had a bowl of Jell-O and you grab the side of the bowl and the Jell-O starts moving. So that makes you think of the deformation of the brain inside the skull. And that's the basis for my first slide. The brain distorts, and how do you visualize the distortion? Well, here is a piece of the brain, or brain soft tissue, in a reference configuration. That's the starting idea of mechanics. If we're going to talk about strain, we need to have a reference state from which we can measure things. So I'm going to choose a snapshot of my brain right now, that instant I just mentioned. That's my reference state. I'm going to imagine a grid of lines drawn in the brain this way. If I shake my head or my blood beats and there's cerebrospinal fluid pressure changing the shape of the brain, all these lines are going to become curved in some way. They're going to stretch both vertically and horizontally, and all these angles are going to change from right angles to some other angles. So that's how we visualize distortion, going from this, what I have chosen as the reference configuration, to this as the current configuration. When the brain moves, I visualize not the brain as a bagel, but this is just a demo device. I visualize parts of the brain trying to move relative to other parts. Okay? So the distortion tries to tear things apart. And internal forces arise to maintain the cohesion of the brain if we're lucky. We don't have any damage. Oh, I'm going to go back to one other statement I should have made. How do we in mechanics visualize the material? We visualize small blocks of material in the reference configuration. And we visualize that they're stacked vertically this way and this way and through the depth of the brain perpendicular to the screen. We focus on what happens to the block as this distorts from this shape to this shape right here. Now, if we look at the mathematics of deformation, and we look at the differential block, we see that it's going to go from a cube shape like this with right angles to a parallel piping. And that shows us that all these edges change length, and all these right angles become different angles. And our basic ideas of mechanics have to do with relating deformation from here to a parallel piping. But that's a complicated shape. It involves stretching in several directions, different strains, different angular strains. So we decompose the deformation of the parallel pivot into length strains and angle changes. So here's a block of material, any kind of material, maybe a cube cut out of a brain, in the reference configuration. And there it is later, all the edges have changed length. Another form of deformation is this shear deformation, which you've seen referred to. There's no length changes at all. This ledge doesn't change length when the thing deforms. That distance doesn't change. The distance C doesn't change. All that happens is the top surface moves parallel to the bottom surface. That induces an angle change right there. So there are two kinds of strains. We could talk about length strains and angle strains. And I think most of the conversation of this meeting and this workshop has really been on length strains. Well, when the block distorts, the external shape changes, but that forces the material inside to change shape also. So we think we're measuring strains, we actually think we're measuring something about what happens to the molecular structure of the material. The molecular structure of the material gets distorted and produces internal cohesive forces. How do you visualize the internal cohesive forces? Fortunately, we had bagels this morning. If I try to twist this way and tear the top half relative to the bottom half, I'm visualizing an internal surface of the bagel, which you see right there. And the right half of the bagel exerts a force on the left half of the bagel. If we disrupt that internal surface, as we've seen happen this morning, we no longer have any cohesive force, so that I can move the top half relative to the bottom half. That's failure. We don't want that to happen. Okay, I'm through with this bagel. Does anybody want to munch on it? Usually when I do this in class, I cough all over it first just to make sure it's totally disgusting. Okay, so we have these forces that are trying to rend this right-hand side asunder from this left-hand side. Well, how do you visualize that? Well, we visualize that internal surface of mechanics. We visualize the forces on that internal surface, and we also have to be aware that the force is distributed, which means that at each area increment, that area carries part of the total force. And the force arrows here are at an angle to the surface, but we generally decompose this into a part perpendicular surface and a part tangent. That's just a random array of the total surface into about 12 pieces. It gives us a crude idea of how the load is distributed. What we do next is let the areas get smaller and smaller, and consider a differential area here, and we introduce the idea of stress. Force intensity, normal to the surface, or force intensity tangential to the surface. So the notion of stress we've heard mentioned a lot also really should be thought of as representing an internal cohesive force intensity, or an internal cohesive force per unit area. And I like to use the word cohesive, it's what holds things together. And the word intensity is important also, because it makes a difference whether I hold this thing on my hand like that, and the load is distributed, or I take this ballpoint pen and sit on top, and now it really hurts. The load intensity has gone up. Material is going to fail in a second if I don't take this away. So the load intensity concept, the stress concept, is very important. Also important is the notion of strain. And we know that there are two kinds of strain, elongational strain and shear strain. The elongation is the change in length over the amount of material that can actually change length. So it becomes a change in length, unit length. The shear strain is a change from a right angle. Now we have to consider both. Let's talk about stress-strain equations. Well, we talk about stress-strain equations for each individual block of material. So if I talk about the total brain as a stack of blocks, this is a typical block, and we're going to talk about relating the stress produced by that block to how much it changes length. And now I've drawn a graph of the normal stress pulling on the block to the strain, change in length per unit length. And I've assumed we have linear elasticity, so there's a nice straight line relationship. There's a lot of stuff hidden in this equation which describes the straight line. The first thing hidden in there is this. At each instant, the stress is related to the strain at that instant. What is not said is almost as important as what is said. This does not depend upon strain rate. In elasticity, this says it does not depend upon strain rate at all. Only depends on the instantaneous strain. Secondly, it's a linear relationship. We could have a different E for each different small block of material. That allows us to put in homogeneity into the model. But there's one other point. Notice that when the strain is zero, the stress is zero. What this really means is we've assumed that when the current shape coincides with the original shape, that original shape had no stress in it. Everything that we've heard at this conference says that there's no residual stress in the material when we started measuring things. We have not accounted for any stresses that may have been in the sample before we started doing any deformations. So hidden in this statement is the implicit assumption that if we go back to the original block, material is entirely stress-free, which we know can't be the case. So that's something that has to be put into our thinking. We could do the same thing for shear. The amount of shear stress tangent to the surface and top is going to be proportional to the amount of angle change. So there's the angle change this way and the amount of shear. That introduces a new modulus, G. Now we have two different moduli. We've heard the word Young's modulus a lot in the conference. That has to mean the tensile modulus. Got to be careful now. There are several moduli that get introduced by tension. But what we generally mean by Young's modulus is this. When we pull this way, we produce nothing on the top or bottom surfaces. The sides can pull in as they wish. So this is the modulus when we have free lateral contraction. But there are experimental techniques which measure a longitudinal modulus. They involve wave propagation. In the longitudinal modulus, these dimensions stay fixed. And I've seen big arguments between material scientists at the University of Michigan and material scientists at General Motors because they didn't understand the difference between tensile modulus that we used here and the idea of longitudinal modulus, where these dimensions don't change length. So we have to be careful which modulus we talk about. There's also Poisson's ratio, which relates to this transverse strain to the elongational strain, which I won't say anything about. And the bulk modulus, which came up in the first talk today, I think, which relates the volume change strain to the pressure causing the volume change strain. Okay, and the last thing I'll talk about is stiffness, because even though it's a simple, trivial idea, I think it helps to see these graphs. What do we mean when we say a material is softer or stiffer than another material? We're trying to take an intuitive feeling and put it into an equation form. And we can measure stiffness by the slope of this line or by the size of the modulus. For example, if I prescribe stress, I can calculate the strain for this stiffer material by going over here and projecting down. There's the E1 strain for the stiffer material. Here's the strain for the softer material. Naturally, it comes out if you give a given stress and the material is softer, it's going to deform more. It's easier to squeeze a marshmallow than it is to squeeze a piece of steel. Or, if we impose a given strain on the material, squeeze down the marshmallow, the softer material takes a lot less stress than if it were a piece of stone. So, inherent ideas of stiffness. That's all I want to say about elasticity per se. Oh, I want to go back to one thing. I didn't think to put this in my transparencies because I didn't think of the idea, but it came up during the conference. Anisotropy. Well, I've shown testing left and right relative to the material. But if the material is anisotropic, if I do the same picture up and down relative to the material, I might get a different elastic modulus. If I do the same test fore and aft relative to the material, I may get a different elastic modulus. So that's what anisotropy is about. Different elastic modulus this way versus that way. And I think we all know those ideas intuitively, but it helps to see these things stated. Let's move on to viscoelasticity. Those ideas are pretty standard ideas. You're all generally familiar with them, but there are a few points I wanted to make about them. Viscoelasticity is less well known to material, to people. Here's a block of material, a polymer, or a biological tissue, and here we stretched it. Now, when we talk about viscoelasticity, we're really talking about time dependence of material behavior. So time has to enter into our thinking. So when we talk about time response, we have to say, are we going to control a strain or are we going to control a stress? We have strain control experiments and stress control experiments. This is a strain control experiment, the idea of stress relaxation. What we do is take a specimen and we say the strain is going to jump from here to here, the length is going to change from here to here, and be held fixed. That's strain control. Graphically, here's the time axis, here's the strain axis. The strain jumps from zero to some value and is held fixed. And what happens in a polymer or biotissue is we pull, and it's hard to hold, and then gradually things relax out. That's the idea of stress relaxation. Mathematically, all that means is if we plot stress versus time, the graph of stress versus time drops down like this. There's an initial value that the stress jumps to, and we suddenly elongate the system. Because of the macromolecular rearrangements inside the material, the stress required to hold the thing in place gradually decreases, and it goes to some asymptotic non-zero value. We know it has to be a non-zero value, by the way. Why? If this dropped all the way to zero, it would mean that no stress is required to hold the material in the deformed state. It means we can let it go. It would stay there. Well, if you talk about brain, and if the stress relaxes all the way to zero, it means your brain is really a fluid. That's what a fluid is. You can hold it in the new shape with no stress. Well, if you take the brain out and put it on the table, if it were a fluid, it would become a big puddle. It doesn't become a big puddle. I mean, it keeps its shape. So we know that there has to be some long-term residual asymptotic value. The things that are important in viscoelasticity is how big is this jump? What does the asymptotic value become? How fast, how far does the stress drop? And how long does it take to get from here to here? We haven't talked much about the characteristic time response of the material, but time is going to be something we'll talk about. Well, that's one experiment. Creep experiment. This is a stress control condition. Now we're going to take the specimen and apply a fixed stress to the material. And that means we're going to jump the load up or the stress up, and it's going to stay fixed for all time. What's going to happen is the same molecular mechanisms which govern stress relaxation say we're going to get an instantaneous jump in strain to some value, and it's going to gradually increase to some asymptotic value. If the material is a solid, it's going to hit this asymptotic value. If it's a fluid, it's going to continue to flow forever. So we know that it's got an asymptote in some way. And of course, the things that are interesting, how big is this jump, how big is that asymptote, and how long does it take to get from here to here? What we want to know is, how does this property G, which depends on strain and time, depend on both time and strain? The first thing I'll talk about is, how does it depend upon strain? Because that's the key to whether we're talking about linear or nonlinear viscoelasticity. What people do is a bunch of step strain tests, plot the G function for all these different step strain values, freeze time, consider fixed time, and they construct what are called isochrones. They plot the value of this function versus strain at different fixed times. If that plot is a straight line like this, the material is linear. If the plot is curved like this, it's called nonlinear. That's a simple definition. And we assume that the strain amplitude is sufficiently small. We're down in this region. We almost have a straight line tangent of small strain, and everything should be linear if the strains are sufficiently small. So let's assume we're going to deal with linear viscoelasticity, which allows us to say that stress has the strain to the first power times some function of time, or the strain is equal to the stress to the first power times some function of time. And that introduces two material expressions, a stress relaxation modulus, G, and a creep compliance, J. Now, when I talk about elastic materials, the material property was a single number, the slope of a straight line. No, this is the material property. This function of time is the material property. It's not a constant. Each new material has a different relaxation property. Each new material, if you look at data, shows a different initial value, a different long-term value, and a different time course we're getting from here to here. So when we talk about material properties for viscoelastic materials, we really have to think in terms of finding not constants, but functions of time. Whether we're doing strain control experiments or stress control experiments, that's true. Now, I've added one thing to this graph that I haven't shown before, this characteristic time. How long does it take to get from here to here? There are lots of definitions of characteristic time, no unique definition. I like to use this as the centroid of the graph. It's exactly the balance point of the graph. It's roughly when two-thirds of the stress is relaxed out to where it's going to go. And that's a convenient measure of relaxation time. If the material is linear, we can show that this J is the inverse of this G, and that J is the inverse of this G. And we can develop expressions for the characteristic creep time, how long it takes for the strain to creep from here to here. We can develop expressions for this time in terms of this time. It turns out that the creep time is always substantially longer than the relaxation time. If the relaxation time is 1 second, the creep time might be 10 minutes. Characteristic features of viscoelastic response, just to tie things in with elasticity. If we do things really rapidly, then we talk about stress versus strain, and the slope of the line would be, there would be a straight line slope, because it's linear viscoelasticity, the slope of the line would be G of zero. We did things really slowly and waited for a long time for things to happen and equilibrate out. We get a straight line relationship with the slope being G infinity. This slope is obviously steeper than this. This is short time response and called glassy response in ordinary polymers. It's called glassy for the reason it has roughly the stiffness of glass. And this is called rubbery because it's become so soft. Remember the graph I showed you in stiffness and softness. This is called rubbery because this has been so soft that roughly it has the consistency and texture of rubbery materials. There's another way of describing viscoelastic materials. Instead of controlling things in time and doing step strain tests or a step stress test, people often do sinusoidal strain tests. So they show a graph of strain that looks like this. This is one period of a sinusoidal oscillation. And you can describe the sinusoidal oscillation by E naught sine omega t. There are two things one can control here, the frequency of the sinusoid, or the period of oscillation, and the amplitude of the strain. If the amplitude of the strain is sufficiently small, then the stress response looks like this. We input a sine omega t. The stress has both a sine and a cosine. It's sinusoidal, and so here's the graph showing the stress behaving sinusoidally in time. But there's an out-of-phase component. The stress graph is shifted relative to the strain graph. But notice something. Something that's not said, but should be observed. The stress oscillates with the same frequency as the strain. That's an indication of linear behavior. If we keep doing experiments like this and increase the strain amplitude, eventually, because of nonlinearity, we'll pick up sine 2 omega, 3 omega, 4 omega terms. And when those terms appear, that's an indication of impending nonlinear behavior. Now we get these moduli, G prime and G double prime, which tells us the relative importance of the sine term and the cosine term, and they depend upon the frequency. Why? Because the frequency is related to the period of oscillation. This introduces the characteristic time of a process. And what's important to the material is the time of the process relative to its relaxation time. There's nothing absolute in these materials. It's the relation of this process time relative to the characteristic relaxation of the material. And if you do things faster or shorter or longer relative to that characteristic relaxation time, that means that G prime and G double prime are going to depend upon the frequency. We have new material property functions. They're functions. They're frequency dependent. And so once again, we have a situation where we can't describe a viscoelastic material by a constant. We have to have some kind of function that describes the behavior of the material. G prime is called the storage modulus. G double prime is called the loss modulus for a reason I'll explain in a second. But this is tied in with the fact that we can recover energy when we do an oscillation. This is tied in with the fact that we dissipate energy. That's what I'm going to talk about next. Here's a very simple example. Here's a block of viscoelastic material, maybe a cube of brain cut out of a rat or an administrator. Sorry, Sif. I don't know if there's much difference. Or a lawyer. Yeah, pick an independent quantity, a lawyer. Cube cut out of a lawyer. Bottom edge is glued to a surface, top edge has a mass attached to it. Disturb the mass and release it. And this mass is going to oscillate back and forth. Is this dying? Yeah, this is dying. I got this up. No, we're getting, is that any red you're seeing? Okay. Sorry. The mass is going to oscillate back and forth. Thank you. I got this at a conference last weekend. Yeah. Okay. And so this mass is going to oscillate back and forth, and here's a trace of a possible oscillation. Well, if our brain were purely elastic, it'd still be oscillating if I did this. It'd still be oscillating. And every time you move your head, it'd still be oscillating. You hear, it's still oscillating, right? You could even hear the amplitudes of the oscillation if you listen carefully. But stuff dies out fast in the brain. The stuff, one or two oscillations, and it's come back to where it was. Or maybe, so over, this is alive again. It might just decay down to here. So there's clearly dissipative processes in biological tissue if we're worried about head impact studies. The dissipation is tied in with the relaxing part of the relaxation function. Here I've taken the relaxation function, decomposed it into its asymptotic base, and this time decay part. The consequences of stress relaxation means delta G does not equal to zero. But that also means that G double prime does not equal to zero. It also means that there's dissipation in the material. It also means the oscillations die out. So stress relaxation implies loss modulus. Loss modulus implies stress relaxation. You can show that mathematically. And both imply that there's a phase difference between the stress response and the strain input. So all those things are connected together, and the brain is highly dissipative as far as I can tell. New idea. I've talked about either step strains, step stresses, or oscillatory strains. What about general strain histories? Well, this is a general model that one can establish for linear viscoelasticity, one-dimensional. Notice elasticity might be this term on the left and this term on the right. But what viscoelasticity says is the stress at the current instant depends on all the strains from the starting time of an experiment to the current time. And the importance of the relaxation function is that's what appears in this convolution integral. Notice something else. This strain appears to the first power here into the first power here. That's what we mean by linear viscoelasticity, this nature of the strain dependence. There is no generally accepted relation between stress, strain, and time for nonlinear viscoelasticity. I could have written down a number of different forms, but I don't know if any of them is truly correct or experimentally verified. So I'll just say that there still is a lot of work to be done to know how much nonlinearity there is and what the form of the relation ought to be. So I'm going to think in terms of this. I want to talk about process time relative to material relaxation time in a little more detail. So here's a relaxation function I've chosen to think about, a simple single-term exponential behavior. Here's the initial value of the relaxation function. There's the asymptotic value. T sub r is the actual relaxation time of the material. It's the centroid of the graph. I'm going to swing back and forth between these two because something I'm doing wrong. Okay, I'm going to consider an experiment in which I get to a strain of 5% at a constant rate. But I'm going to consider getting to that strain at 0.05 at 1/10 of a relaxation time, or exactly in one relaxation time, or in three relaxation times, a fast, medium, and slow process. If we look at the relation between stress strain and time for linear viscoelasticity, use this form for the relaxation function, input this information, we can plot the stress versus the physical time relative to the relaxation time of the material. If we do things fast, we can get to the strain really quickly, and we produce a pretty high stress. If we do things at medium speed, this graph right here, we get to the same strain a little more slowly, and the stress is not so high. If we do things really, really slowly relative to the relaxation time of the material, there's the stress time plot. I'm going to replot this because this is what people do experimentally. Because strain is proportional to time, I can rescale this horizontal axis and now construct a stress strain graph. Same strain at all different processes, 0.05, but I get the different rates that I can construct the stress strain graph for each of the processes. Here's the stress strain graph for fast loading, medium loading, and slower loading. First of all, material appears to be softer because I can get to this strain, 0.04, with much less stress for slow loading than I can with fast loading. So that shows that the rate of loading relative to the relaxation time is important. But now I want to upset you. I'm talking about getting results from a linear viscoelastic material which is producing a nonlinear stress strain relation. Let me say that again. A linear viscoelastic material has a nonlinear stress strain equation. This is insane. What's happening is we are misusing the term linear. Linear in viscoelasticity refers to the nature of the strain dependence and nothing else. It says stress depends on strain to the first power. The nonlinearity of this graph really comes from the fact that we constructed it from a stress time graph. And what one can show at each instant is the slope of this graph is proportional to the stress relaxation function. So the reason nonlinearity comes in is because of the very fact of stress relaxation. Or I want to say that differently. The reason we do not get straight line stress strain plots is exactly because of stress relaxation. And the amount of relaxation that occurred depends upon the rate at which we produce the strain at. Okay, and I'm going to confound you a little bit more. Because this is neuromechanics, because I have some weird ideas I want to get your reaction to, keep in mind that this is a graph in which I've kept the material fixed and I've adjusted the strain rate. Now I'm going to do something different. This is the same basic graph, but with a different set of thoughts on it. Real polymers are sensitive to temperature change. If you increase the temperature in a real polymer, stress relaxation occurs faster. So, for example, if I've got three different temperatures, T1 smaller than T2 smaller than T3, cooler, medium, hot, the relaxation time for this is bigger than the relaxation time for this is bigger than the relaxation time for this. If we keep the strain rate fixed, but adjust the relaxation time by changing the temperature, here's the process for a low temperature, which looks like we're loading fast relative to the material, and here's the process for a higher temperature when the relaxation time has decreased. It has decreased, so the process looks like it's really slow compared to the relaxation time. Now, in your minds, I want you to change thinking from temperature to thinking about a non-mechanical parameter, perhaps age, perhaps disease, however you measure disease, or medication, and how those might affect the relaxation time. Perhaps by giving somebody a drug, that drug changes the chemical processes going on to control stress relaxation. The material can relax faster or slower, and that can reduce the level of stress that gets built up on the material. So I'm suggesting the possibilities. Here's where mechanics and biochemistry interact. Now, I've talked about the influence of these factors on a relaxation time. What about these two parameters? Well, temperature in non-biopolymers, the temperature effects usually don't change these at all. But there are ways of changing those, and that brings me to the third part of my talk, models for microstructural change. Elastomeric materials. These are networks of long-chain molecules, macromolecular materials, which are cross-linked. So here's the network, and these lines represent long-chain molecules. These dots represent the cross-links, the chemically connected to one another. I like to think in terms of spaghetti. The long-chain molecules are like spaghetti noodles, and they may be connected to one another by Parmesan cheese, or they may be able to slide past one another. The Parmesan cheese connection is representing these cross-links. If you use statistical mechanics to figure out what the tensile modulus of this is, if you're a polymer science, the modulus of this network in tension, E, depends on three factors. Absolute temperature, K is Boltzmann's constant, which comes out of the fact that we're doing statistics, and N is the cross-link density. The modulus is proportional to the cross-link density. We can do things to change the cross-link density. That's what's of interest here. We can change this cross-link density. I've done it mathematically by considering the influence of large deformations. A colleague of mine in Michigan and I have done it experimentally by raising the temperature of an elastomer. And when you raise the temperature, there are oxidation processes which are allowed to occur, which break the cross-links. The cross-links are formed like this, and they break. The terminology is called scission. There's like a scissors effect cutting the cross-links. But I'm suggesting that the cross-links might change in the presence of a diffusing fluid, which carries something which affects the cross-link. And here's where, again, biochemistry comes in. Or some other biochemical factor, which I don't know anything about. But we can change N by a number of possible different processes. So what's likely to happen? My fingers are now the long-chain molecules, and where my fingers are touching are the cross-links. And we pull the material, and everything is stretched apart. Cross-links break. Now these have dangling long-chain molecules. These long-chain molecules recoil. By the way, right now it's hard to pull my hands apart, but by this I've broken one cross-link, it's a little easier to pull my hands apart. These long-chain molecules recoil, and they reform. The reformation occurs in the stretched state of the material. And they reform to produce a new elastomeric network in the material. The new elastomeric network has a new reference or unstressed state. So now we're talking about materials with multiple reference configurations. The original network is unstressed relative to the initial state we found it at. The new network is unstressed relative to the current state it's at. And that has big implications. So I'm going to talk about a mathematical model. The basic premise is of this. There's continuous scission of cross-links of the original network by one of a variety of processes, either by high temperature or chemical processes or anything else we can think of. And the cross-links continuously reconnect to form new networks with new reference states. And here is a simplified model based upon the ideas of linear elasticity. If there were no network scission at all, this integral would not be there. This B would equal to 1, and this would be stresses proportional to the strain. And so E naught would represent the elastic modulus of the original network. This integral represents the fact that we're continually producing new elastic networks. Each network has its own modulus, so there's a network formed at time t hat with modulus E at time t hat. This is the strain produced in that network relative to the configuration it formed at. B1 is what happens to the original network. It's the volume fraction of the cross-links, or the volume fraction of the original network remaining at time t. That monotonically decreases. A of t is the rate of production of new network, and we could also break down the new network that it forms. This is the amount of network remaining at time t that formed at time t hat. So these are all the basic parameters in this model. Now, this is a combined mechanics-chemical model because these parameters, B1, A, and B2, can either be determined by experiment or predicted from biochemical kinetics. At Michigan, I worked with a colleague in aerospace. We've measured these by doing experiments at high temperatures. We've measured these at high temperatures as a function of temperature and time. And we've supported our findings by going to the polymer chemistry literature and showing that they're justified by biochemical processes. So this is where we could combine the biochemistry that we've heard about in a lot of these talks with the mechanical framework that we're setting up here. What is the consequence of these events? Remodeling of the original material. Let me go back to this. Eventually, this function is going to decay all the way to zero. All the original networks is going to disappear. And the original material is going to be replaced by a series of overlaid new networks. That's what this model says. So eventually, this function B1 starts off at the value 1. At some time, it has decayed to zero. All that's left is the integral term, which I've rewritten like this. This is the strain. Here is the new modulus material, because that expression appears in the modulus slot. And this represents what we might get as residual strain if the stress is set equal to zero. The new modulus depends upon these material property functions, which are probably determined by some biochemical process. And this is the elasticity of the new networks that form. Here are some plots to suggest what this theory is all telling us about. These are plots of shear stress versus shear strain for a rubbery material. The material is initially Neo-Hookian with no process of breaking down the networks at all, as this graph right here. The C represents the volume fraction of the original network that has ultimately broken down. Breaking down starts at a shear strain of around 0.5 and stops at a shear strain of about 2.5. If there is 25% breakdown of the original material in forming new networks, the original straight line graph, which had a constant stiffness, just generally gets softer. And when you unload from here, which is a stretch, a shear of 2, it doesn't go back to zero. The new networks prevent it from returning to where it originally was and produces a residual deformation. The more conversion of the original network to the final network, the more the material softens. You notice they can go up, then down, and up again. There's a region here we can get a very large amount of deformation for almost constant stress. And then when you unload, it goes back down to a new state. And this is the case where the new network and the original network have the same stiffness. This is a case where the new network is softer than the original network, for whatever reasons. And this is the case when the new network is stiffer than the original network. So we could, in the biochemical processes, think of various things which might affect the network structure, causing the scission, might affect the stiffnesses of the individual networks, and get various amounts of softening in the material. Now I want to show you some results of an experiment. This is a sheet of rubber, flat. It's got dots on it because we're using a photographic technique to see how this deforms. We clamp the sheet on this circular boundary, so it's now horizontal. We pressurized it one side by glycerin at a high temperature, 100 degrees centigrade, allowed it to interact with the rubber. The glycerin does not interact with the rubber at all, but allowed it produces pressure on the rubber. Because the rubber is at a high temperature, 100 degrees centigrade, the networks are breaking down. The original network is failing, and new networks are being formed, and slowly this rubber is being inflated like a balloon. What we did then is after about, I forget how many hours, maybe 10 hours, we stopped the process, turned off the pressure, pulled the glycerin away, cooled things down, and we got this deformed state. This flat sheet of rubber has been remodeled to a new shape. And we've trapped a new shape in the material. And notice that these dots, all of original, same original diameter, look how big they are, 2 to 3 times the original size. And the size of the dots change from the center to the edge. So there's a remodeling process that goes on, producing a non-homogeneous deformation, and we can model this, and we have modeled this process using the equations I showed you in previous slides. And I think remodeling, according to my conversations with Karina, somehow goes on during the process of aging and other things in the hydrocephalus and other effects. Well, brings me to the end. I've tried to produce some concepts from the mathematical theory of continuum mechanics, just which I think might be useful in thinking about hydrocephalus and other issues in brain mechanics. And I try to show that when these ideas of mechanics are coupled with other disciplines, I think they may be usefully brought to bear in the study of brain neuromechanics. Thank you. Yes.
I think there are probably multiple constituents in the brain.
So I haven't put that into my thinking. But I talked about Karina, the neurons, perhaps that is a reinforcement. They prevent the...
At the moment, I'm thinking about retinal tissue, which is part of...
Oh, okay. Yeah.
On a flat sheet of tissue.
Okay.
There are cells that scan the entire thickness of the...
Yeah, yeah. They don't stretch at all?
Not really.
Okay.
As soon as you apply some stretch,
yeah.
They start contracting.
That's interesting. I don't know how to talk about that, but I will say this. I'm going to jump to a different idea. You accidentally saw a file labeled boa constrictor. All right? And I was doing a stupid analysis of a boa constrictor wrapped around some kind of animal, just to be silly. The boa constrictor was a muscle model. Now, muscle operates because of contraction. All right? There's this interdigitation process. And what that contraction does is a consequence of chemical actions which changes the reference state of the material. And then you shorten the material by this chemical event, and then you stretch everything out. So you get a combination of changing the reference state by chemical means and then applied mechanical stresses to stretch it back out again. So maybe this is an idea which can be brought to bear what you're talking about. But that's as much as I think I can add.
So you're sort of wondering whether there's like a residual stress within you?
I think he might be saying that there's a reference state that can be changed by chemical means.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
So muscle models would somehow be useful for that.
And actually, in my talk, they actually showed the other model, and I actually used the activation function. The one that was actually provided by a function MRI showing different.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you think about the quasi-linear?
I would use that because it's the next easiest thing to use. So, yes. And you keep using the more and more complex models until you can't use them anymore. I mean, that's all you can do. Because the experimental effort required to... Well, there's a thing called the Kolmenogh finite linear viscoelasticity model, which has too much stuff to measure. There's an experimental program which did it for styrene butadiene rubber, which lasted about 10 years. So take the next easiest thing. Occam's razor. Kathleen. Right. I don't know how to do it. I just raised the issue that... Yeah, this is a big... Yeah, the determination of residual stress in biotissue is a major area in other areas of biomechanics. And there's no good answer for this. People are just guessing all over the place about what the residual stress pattern might be and how they might go about finding it. Yeah. So we're a long way from knowing how to handle whatever residual stresses might be there, what the consequences might be.
Okay, so let's thank Alan again, and the last one, folks, you can have coffee and refreshments.
Uh-oh. Okay, close. You. How do I get out of here?
This is your computer here?
This is their computer. Now I don't want to pull my